Hello, this is Deborah on Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the last week of July. This week, we are very happy to have one of our favorite guests back on the program, Dr. Jeff Hammerson. Jeff has been on the radio with us several times, speaking on various different subjects, but today he will be wearing his ornithology hat, as our main topic is woodpeckers of the Olympic Peninsula. Welcome, Jeff. Nice to have you back again.
Thank you. Good to be here with you, Deborah.
Well, we thought that we'd start with a review of some of the recent natural history news out there because it's such a busy time of year. There's been a lot going on. One of the amazing things this year seems to be what a good year it is for raptors. I don't know if you've seen more than usual, but I've been lucky enough to be on an email thread with Varn Brooks and Karen Lull, and Varn takes these gorgeous photographs, and they live out Cape George way, and they found a merlin nest.
Oh, wow.
I know. And, you know, I always think of merlins as these rare falcons, but they're increasingly popping up in the landscape here. And they found a nest, and they were able to monitor it. And I have some quotes from Varn. He was saying, "We were pretty sure our merlins had nested successfully and finally saw our first fledgling on Independence Day. Believe that three young fledged successfully, probably four. My old Audubon Encyclopedia says they commonly lay four or five eggs, occasionally up to eight." Occasionally up to eight. Doesn't that seem extraordinary
to
you? It does.
The extremes are sometimes hard to imagine, but it's rare. You know, so mostly the clutch size would be a lot smaller than that. But for some reason, maybe there's a bountiful food supply or something like that, and the female just keeps laying eggs. And
can you imagine
eight?
A nest with
no.
eight falcons? So anyway, he does go on to say, it doesn't say how often they fledge that many, and you just answered that. They are very efficient hunters. In the time we've been watching the nest, it looks like they average about one songbird an hour. One day I saw the male bring in three birds in 90 minutes. I usually went about the same time in the evening, so I don't know if they hunted that hard every day, but I think they were feeding a lot of mouths. They're not much for nest building. It looks like the ones we are seeing used an old crow nest. They usually usurp a corvid or hawk nest and look for a fresh spot each year. So that was really cool. And then they also saw, a couple weeks later, saw a peregrine flying past with what looked like a dove in its talons. And then they saw a juvenile kestrel hanging about and catching and eating insects.
Wow, cool.
So, yeah.
And around where I live, there's been a successful nesting of Cooper's hawks. Two different nests that I know of.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. They've been moving around, so they're not around every day now because the young have fledged, but they're still getting fed by their parents. And
you know, I thought I heard a little beep. I mean, those young are really loud, too.
They are.
Yeah. They must have nested farther away than they usually do from my house, because I usually hear them more than mm-hmm. what I did this year.
Mm-hmm. And how about our neighbors who had the eagle nest?
Oh, well, George and Julia Maynard are our neighbors, and they have had an active bald eagle nest at their property. And Julia's been really good about keeping careful notes. And I think she said the 23rd of May, anyway, mid-May to the third week of May, she saw them sitting on eggs, which doesn't that seem really late? I mean, usually they have like courtship breeding behavior in January, February. So it seems like May would be late to be on the nest.
A little bit toward the end of the normal season, but you know, perhaps there was something that interfered with the start of the nesting, or sometimes they'll lose an egg and have to start over. Maybe decide not to use that nest this year, but maybe use a different one. So they could have switched, because they usually have more than one potential place to nest in their territory. But hard to know without being privy to those little details.
Yeah. Well, she said that one of the young was definitely younger than the other one, that mm-hmm, she thought there was about a week spacing, but they ended up fledging two, and they've been having a lot of fun watching them. And they've been mostly being brought fish by the adults, but on a couple of occasions they saw some seagull bits come into the nest. And she just sent me a video this morning, the 23rd of July. She's been she showed me this little video clip of the young stretching out their wings just about ready to fly, and they're giant. I mean, it's really hard to believe how they could fit in the nest, these two giant birds.
Yeah, and speaking of fitting in a nest, back in April and May, we were watching some nesting barred owls.
That's right. Rick Altman, another of our neighbors, sent out the word about barred owls nesting.
Yeah, and so toward the middle of May, the young birds were getting very, very hungry, and it was hard to tell how many were inside the nest. It was a old snag with a big hole in it and had been used by raccoons, actually, in, I think that was last year. But anyway, so they were bringing food into some pretty big youngsters around mid-May, and that is when they came out.
And Rick phoned Jeff with enough lead time. Jeff has become the nature photographer, photo documenter for the neighborhood, and he gets the call and comes with his camera and takes these gorgeous photos. And you got some really nice photos of them before they fledged with just their heads poking out.
Yeah, at that point I didn't know how many were in there, but some of the feedings were interesting. So a red-legged frog came in as one feeding and was gobbled down by the nestling. Another time it was a shrew.
Wow. Another, and you don't think of shrews as being that tasty for anyone, but apparently
yeah,
they
are. Yeah, it went right down the hatch, believe me. And then a creeping vole or meadow mouse, some people call those.
Well, and that's the beauty of having your big camera, is that you can freeze that still. And then, I mean, you never, well, I shouldn't say never, but it would be hard to see it with just your binoculars or even your spotting scope. It's when you take the still frame and then you can blow it up and go, oh, that's a creeping vole.
Yeah, yeah. Most of the time when the food came in, it went in fast and it went down the hatch fast. And I didn't even really know at the time what it was, but I was taking often video. And so I could stop the video and say, oh, a frog, or oh, a shrew. And then another item after they actually fledged, and there ended up being three fledglings all crowded into that little nest, and they came out. One of them was fed a black rat, which kind of made me happy a little bit, since it's not a native species around here, but nevertheless.
And neither is the barred owl, but it's nice when there's, they take care of something that is a plague to us. And Jeff has the most amazing photo of this rat being half consumed with one claw out one side of the mouth and the tail out the other. It's really, really
creepy.
It is
a little outrageous.
I know.
The foot hanging on to the bill as if like, no, no.
I know. The perfect Halloween shot.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Oh, that's great. But one of those juveniles starved, right? That you found it dead.
Yeah, I found it dead. And so I did a little autopsy on it, so to speak, and found that it had nothing in its digestive system, and it had no body fat that I could find whatsoever. And so I think it just, there wasn't enough food to feed all of the youngsters. And that one, I think that the adults make a decision, basically, I think a very informed decision probably, about which ones they should feed when there's a shortage of food. And it turns out that only one of the three nestlings is still around.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When I saw them, there were two. But I've been seeing, you know, and you find them by the mobbing sound of other birds, and you track it down, and it'll be one of the young barred owls that's still being fed by the adults.
Yeah, this goes on for months.
Yeah. But I didn't realize, that I was thinking that there were probably still two left,
no,
just one.
Just one.
Huh. Well, it's a hard world out there, isn't it? And people are going to think that it's only birds are happening out there because we're so bird-focused. But there's a lot of other cool stuff. I've been finding really beautiful prince mushrooms, which are not only beautiful and delicious, but it's so strange that they should fruit at this time of year when it's so dry. I mean, especially this year, and they're these giant mushrooms. I mean, it's well known that rainfall and temperature are the major determining factors in the fruiting of fungi, but I've just been puzzling over how it's possible that they should be able to come up and be so prolific. And so I was searching around and I found from David Arora's Mushroom Bible, Mushrooms Demystified, him talking about prince mushrooms. And he says, Agaricus augustus shows a definite preference for warm weather. It's curious that such a large mushroom requires so little moisture to fruit. A little fog drip is all it needs. And then I realized that one of the places that I've been finding it is right along the eave of my house, where just enough moisture drops off and collects there and allows them to come forth. So,
yeah, we've had this dry and sometimes very hot weather, but more recently, even with the sunshine and dryness, that fog in the morning is dripping off the trees around our place, pretty close to the strait. It's been a regular thing, and that little bit of moisture, I think, is making a difference for other things, too. For example, there have been plenty of frogs moving around.
You know, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, Jeff knows a lot about a lot of things, but amphibians are your special love, right?
Well, one of the many. So,
How to choose.
Yeah, but the northern red-legged frogs have been around and foraging, even though there's been no rain to speak of. Pacific tree frog I've found. I just did a little survey over on Maristone Island I joined a survey done by some others where they've put some cover boards down and see what appears underneath them. It's a board on the ground that serves as a refuge for little animals, and you can put these on the ground and kind of see what might use that as cover. And so it's a way of finding things that are otherwise, you know, difficult to find, perhaps in a forest landscape, especially where just so many places to hide. Anyway, we found that between mid-June and mid-July, during this period where we've had some really dry weather and some really hot weather, there were two species of salamanders still moving around. An Encetina, which is a little land-dwelling lungless salamander, never goes in the water, and then long-toed salamander we found, and this is one that breeds in the water but then spends most of its life in the forest. So those had moved, either gone under a board or departed from a cover board over the last 4 weeks. And then banana slugs are all over the place. It's amazing. They're like, just as before we came to the studio today, there was a big one crossing this dry path near where I live, and several others have been around, and they have these amphibians and the banana slugs have these very sophisticated ways of managing their body water content. They find the little refuges when they need them and hydrate, and then they can, they're not big animals, but they can retain moisture. In fact, actually, tree frogs have semi-waterproof skin, so they don't dry out that fast to begin with. But so they're able to move around and take advantage of the season when they're normally doing a lot of feeding, even though it's dry. As a general rule, they find the little refuges or take advantage of the fog drip and stay hydrated.
Wow, very cool. I'll leave you one more opening to tell me something really wonderful that you've seen out there, or we should move on to woodpeckers, or we're never going to get to woodpeckers.
Well, current events are always so good because it's happening now. But what's really been fun is that over the last 1 to 2 weeks, the migratory shorebirds have been showing up.
Oh, you know, I was wondering, I need to do my beach survey. I was wondering if we'd end up.
Greater yellowlegs, least sandpipers, little flocks of those. Both long-billed and short-billed dowitchers have shown up, the adults. Some of these coming from probably northern Alaska, northern Canada, tundra nesting birds. Yellowlegs can nest farther south than those, but still they're on the move. We don't know definitely where they came from because they're not marked in any way, but they generally, I don't say always, show up this time of year, the earliest migrants.
I always love that we start to lose some of our breeding bird population, but our reward is that then we get back to us again, shorebirds, either migrating through or to stay, through the fall and winter.
Yeah, you think of sort of the fall migration, you think of September, October. Well, it's not really fall migration, but the southward migration, if we call it that, begins for shorebirds even at the end of June, but certainly in good numbers in July, before you think, oh, the summer's just starting. But for them, their season is over, and the adults are heading south. Perhaps these are ones that weren't successful breeding and departed. Again, hard to know without having more information than we have, but still kind of interesting to see them. And another thing on the current events schedule, the second successful brood of killdeer has hatched out at Point Hudson.
Oh.
There was a brood that hatched out.
To the great delight of all the people there that noticed, probably. I mean, what is cuter than a baby killdeer?
Not much.
Not much.
But one brood hatched out in mid-May. And I'm not sure it's the same pair. Probably there's a new brood that hatched out about a week ago. And so that's kind of fun to see.
I could do every show just being current events. I love hearing what's out there. But our idea for this show was to talk about woodpeckers. And because...
Oh, yeah.
Well, it was driven by the fact that I found this downy woodpecker nest on my property the third week of May, and I had them there last year, so I was kind of tuned into it, but it took hearing them. I mean, first they sounded like these purring crickets, and I'm like, wait a second, that's not an insect. I know that sound from last year, and it was this nest of downy woodpeckers. I mean, it was this teeny little snag. I could almost put my hands around it. It's tiny. I mean, it makes you realize the importance of snags in the landscape. Here it's housing this downy woodpecker family, and downy woodpeckers are the smallest of our woodpeckers. And this year I had the good sense to call Jeff, and Jeff came with his camera and was able to get these gorgeous photos of the young being fed, I mean, at various different stages. And and again, we learned a lot by being able to look carefully at those photos, because you could see what it was that they were being fed.
Yeah, we could see moths and caterpillars and other sorts of insects and some objects that we couldn't actually even identify.
You know, there
toward
was
the
some,
end.
There was this weird mash that looked like kind of like mashed potatoes, or and the adults were bringing it, and both the male and the female feed the young, and the young just got really demanding. Actually, we should probably play the sounds of those downy woodpeckers. And they got so loud and insistent. I mean, from dawn until dusk, they would yammer and yammer and yammer, and both adults just couldn't keep them happy. There were at least two young. We never did see, we watched them intensely, but they fledged sometime early morning, I think, on the 8th of June, because we kept watching and watching and didn't see them. So we think at least two, but maybe even three young.
Yeah, again, it was hard to tell, but definitely two in there because we could see a different coloration on the tops of the heads. Looked like one little male and one little female in there, if I remember right.
Well, actually, that's what I thought, but then when I was reading, it seems like most of the juveniles have a little spot of red on on their forehead.
Yeah, is both genders do, but the one that has the most red on the cap is the male, and the female nestlings might have a few little feathers there, but it's not so evident at all. So you can usually tell. But yeah, like you say, it's there can be present on the head of the female, little females.
Yeah,
too.
But not with the adult females. That's clearly that the male has the red spot on the back of the head and the female doesn't. But these little nestlings had their red in a different spot. And
It's surprising. You think, oh, they don't have red on the top of their head.
Yeah.
The little nestlings do.
Yeah. Anyway, play us those sounds, if you would, please.
Let's see if we can do this here.
And it was loud. I mean,
on and on. Incessant.
I know. And I was actually really distressed that we didn't see them fledge. I mean, I thought that they would stick around the area, but did not see them again. But then George and Julia, a few weeks later, said that they had seen a little downy family. So I think maybe they moved farther away.
Yeah, I think they moved where they can find a lot of food.
They probably, you know, decimated the area around my house. Because
So we cleaned this area out. We got to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
And they probably know where that somewhere else is.
Yeah.
So they took they led their offspring off in that other direction, wherever it might have been.
Yeah. So the mashed potato stuff we were thinking was like some kind of egg mash, don't you think?
Yeah, I think it was probably some sort of egg mass from something. I couldn't recognize it. It was difficult to, even in the video, to stop and get a sharp look at it. But it was kind of lumpy, kind of off-white material that kind of was in the bill and at the edge and even around the bill a little bit of the adults when they brought it in. So it's somewhat sticky-like, but it could have been egg mass or larvae, not really larvae, but...
Or like wood pulp that had some larva inside, maybe. Anyway, maybe next year.
Maybe next year we'll get a better chance at it. Or maybe in the meanwhile, as we're hiking around in the woods and looking at things, we'll go, aha!
That's it.
I think I'll recognize it if I see it.
Yeah.
So I'm going to start looking under bark and breaking little limbs, maybe a little bit to see what's inside a dead limb or something. It'll be fun to try to figure that one out.
Well, we should probably play the calls, too, of what they normally... Those were the juveniles that were yammering, but...
Yeah, let's hear... Just single note calls. So you often hear that in the woods. You can hear it at some distance. On the recording, I have to say it sounds a little more strident than it does when you're out in the woods. It sounds a little flatter, but I mean, that's just because of the recording, I think. But you can often hear that. And then once in a while, you might hear a different vocalization that's referred to as a whinny. And let's see if we can get that to play.
And the juveniles were starting to do a little bit of that whinny call when they were in the nest.
Yes, they were,
It was fun.
And so both males and females will make those sounds. and communicate who knows what to each other by that means. Here I am, and that's a basic kind of thing, but also what other information content there might be is sort of speculative, but certainly they keep in contact with each other with those calls.
And then they do drumming. They do a territorial, and it's not that they're looking for food, it's that they're declaring territory in a certain area for the most part.
Yeah, it's a way to say, hey, this place is occupied by a pair of downy woodpeckers.
Get out of here.
And,
Get out of here.
So if you're another prospecting pair of downies that are looking for a place, this lets them know that maybe they should look elsewhere. Also a way for a male, for example, to attract a female. But both males and females drum, so it's not as simple as that.
I read about that, which is cool.
But let's listen to a drum from a downy.
That's a cool recording.
So it won't often be that many drums in quick sequence like that. Sometimes there'll be a longer interval, so that varies quite a bit. But that is the bird wrapping its bill rapidly against usually a dead piece of wood or something like that that resonates and sends out that acoustic signal into the landscape.
Oh, cool. Thanks so much for joining us, Jeff, and we'll look forward to hearing more soon.
Sure, we'll probably have to take about 6 months to cover all of
it. I know that'll be nature now for the rest of the season. But before we sign off for today, I would like to acknowledge the tragic loss of a bright spirit in both our Port Townsend and environmental community. Caroline Gibson was a wonderfully warm and engaging human being and a tireless advocate for the marine environment. Having served for several years as the Marine Program Manager at the Northwest Straits Commission and later as Executive Director of the Northwest Straits Foundation, she passed away on July 11th, much too young, after a brave and lengthy battle with cancer, and will be sorely missed by many of us in this community and beyond. In her honor, closing music will be The Sea by Haven.
The long nights are gone with the river. The water's been waiting long, long. Float on the river of time. Hold steady, hold steady. The sea comes cause the summer force thou cold. Both for the change of the tides. Hold steady, hold steady. Storm for hours and rain days.